Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown Podcast. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for DebtWire Municipals. Joining me today are a couple of our fine reporters, Deb Pace and Kunal Kamal. Welcome to the podcast, Deb and Kunal.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Paul.
All right. The title of today's podcast episode is State of the States. Today, we'll be discussing the fiscal challenges facing states and the potential impact of the debt ceiling on the municipal market. So states are really feeling the squeeze as the pandemic funding starts to run out. At the same time, they're dealing with tax revenues that have been dropping. Deb, what are some of the biggest reasons for the declines?
Paul, there are a lot of different reasons in different states. So, for example, income tax revenues are sliding in several states, including Georgia, Massachusetts, and Illinois, where out-migration of residents has had a major impact on things like personal income taxes, which were off 32% through April in Illinois, and that's compared with April 2022. In fact, nearly every state that has reported its income tax numbers has reported a drop in April receipts. The interesting thing is that sales tax revenue growth remains strong in many states, but it's not enough. In Alaska, for example, the state coffers suffered from a drop in the price of oil that led to a projection of nearly $1 billion deficit for the upcoming fiscal year, and state officials were left scrambling to fill a hole in the current budget year to pay for continued operations.
But it's not all bad news, right, Deb? I mean, some states are actually having surpluses. So what's causing the wide disparity in results?
That's right, Paul. Some states were already planning for a softening in the economy, so some of them amassed a large surplus, like Texas, with nearly $33 billion this year, thanks to inflation, increasing prices, and ultimately sales taxes on those goods. The important thing to note is that the swing from a surplus to a deficit can happen fast when pandemic funding begins to run out, like in Illinois, where recent projections showed a $357 million surplus in 2024, with an expected $384 million deficit by 2025. That's expected to grow to $708 million by 2028, unless there's some type of reform.
So we have some states with massive rainy day funds. And we have other states with massive budget deficits. And then we have another group of states with massive rainy day funds and budget deficits, which puts a lot of pressure on lawmakers to make big decisions on whether to tap those reserves. So, for example, in California, they're facing quite the dilemma. Can you break that down a little bit for us, Deb?
Sure, Paul. It is a bit complex. So California has $27 billion in discretionary reserves. It also has about $10 billion in reserves it could use to fund things like schools and community colleges. That's $37 billion in funds that would have to be depleted to alarmingly low levels to cover Governor Gavin Newsom's most recent deficit projection of nearly $32 billion. He attributed it to high inflation costs and delayed tax filings from winter storms. The state has also faced lower tax collections from the stock market decline because nearly 50% of the state's tax money comes from 1% of its earners. They tend to be high-income residents who rely on the stock market for their wealth. The dilemma is that there's a heightened risk of a recession that could exacerbate the state's budget issues in a system that heavily relies on those wealthy taxpayers whose income is dependent on the stock market. That's an extremely vulnerable position ahead of a potential recession. Add to that, Paul, the state's vulnerability to the high-tech industry in general, which has seen thousands of worker layoffs, and the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, which serviced the tech industry. And just as Illinois has seen, a large number of California residents have been exiting the state and moving to other regions with lower taxes and a lower cost of living. That's according to some Census Bureau figures.
So Governor Newsom has some options for dealing with this deficit. One would be to cut spending, but what are other options on the table?
Well, Paul, he has options on top of more than $10 billion in spending cuts in areas like climate programs and infrastructure upgrades and expansion. The governor's also considering clawbacks in unspent program funding, including funding that would help residents with utility bill payments. Some other options include borrowing and pulling from the reserves, as well as raising taxes on some of the state's largest companies. But so far, nothing has been solidified at this time.
So we've been talking a little bit about the West Coast in California. Let's go all the way to the East Coast of the country and talk about New York. What's going on there with their budget issues?
It's been highly reported that municipalities and agencies are having a tough time attracting workers post-pandemic. And in order to keep government services working, states like New York have had to ask workers to fill in where they don't have employees in critical roles. Just last week, the state controller announced that overtime costs at state agencies rose 47.2%. That's up more than $1.36 billion in 2022, and that set a new state record. Overtime hours increased more than 11% to over 22 million over the same period, and overtime earnings made up 7.5% of total payroll spending in 2022. That's quite an increase from the 4.6% average from 2013 to 2021.
Billions, those are big numbers, even for a state like New York.
They are, but the state is paying up because they need people in those essential service worker roles. The top three state offices with the most overtime were developmental disabilities, corrections, and the Office of Mental Health. Those three agencies accounted for more than two-thirds of the state's overtime. Another few offices in the top categories were state police and veterans homes. And another interesting thing about New York was that the attrition rate in 2021 was the highest in the last 10 years, with nearly 17,000 people exiting the workforce. That's up 26% from the prior year. At the same time, new hiring rebounded in 2021 after a steep drop in 2020, but it wasn't enough to match the attrition rate, so the overtime costs continued to climb.
So we have overtime costs squeezing the state budget. And that doesn't even include all the funding that goes to counties and cities, as well as to agencies such as transportation and some utilities that are looking at, quote unquote, bailouts or increased help from the state.
Exactly, Paul. And in the case of New York, there's another consideration. The ballooning overtime costs can have a substantial impact on long-term pension costs, since, as we know, pension rates and payouts are based on the last few years of employment before someone retires. So when you consider that New York's pay per overtime hour was almost one-third higher in 2022 than in 2021, you can begin to see what impact those figures could have on upcoming pension payments.
There's a lot of money going out the door, not enough money coming back in. How do states go about trying to solve these budget problems, Deb?
You know, in New York, one of Governor Kathy Hochul's initiatives includes increasing the minimum wage, which could help create more income tax revenue to pay for overtime and for bailouts such as the recent MTA transit package. In the case of California, it seems the spending cuts and bond borrowing are most likely, though one thing the governor said was off the table was a tax hike to cover the hole. So, you know, it remains to be seen what the true long-term solutions will be in a lot of these states, Paul.
Well, thanks, Deb. One place where the states probably won't be able to get any additional assistance is the federal government, as they struggle to navigate this whole debt ceiling issue that Kunal is going to talk about. So, Kunal, give us some background on what's happening.
Thanks, Paul. So, basically, this is a Mexican standoff in which the only truly vulnerable party is the American economy. There is also an interesting subplot of the developing pen friendship between Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen and Speaker Kevin McCarthy. I say that because in the past few months, Secretary Yellen has sent about half a dozen letters to Speaker McCarthy, urging Congress to raise the national debt limit to avoid a potentially catastrophic default. Most recently on Monday, Secretary Yellen once again warned that the X date, or the date when the government will run out of money if it does not borrow more money, which is the whole debt ceiling about, could be as early as 1st of June. So what initially seemed like a good old political theater is now dangerously close to becoming an unprecedented economic disaster.
So for context, Kunal, for our listeners, we're recording on Wednesday, May 17th, and it seems like this date is coming up really quickly. Well, now, Treasury Secretary Yellen, she's developed a pen pal with Speaker McCarthy, but how come they haven't been able to raise the debt limit and what's causing the impasse?
Thanks, Paul. I think a bit of historical context is required here because the concept of U.S. debt ceiling dates back to 1917 during the First World War, when the Congress established a limit on the amount of debt the government could issue without having the Treasury to come back to seek its approval anytime it wanted to spend any money. This was basically done to facilitate funding of war efforts. And since then, for most parts, it has been a customary process. And it is said that the U.S. has raised its debt ceiling in some form or other at least 90 times in the 20th century itself. last time the debt ceiling was raised in 2021 during President Trump's time by nearly $3 trillion, bringing the new limit to $31.4 trillion where it currently stands. However, it is only in the past 10-12 years that the debt ceiling has become a major political issue amid a growing partisan divide. So this is the third time since 2011 that a Republican majority Congress has come to a face-off with a Democrat president on the debt ceiling. Now, the current situation is that the Republicans in Congress are asking for federal spending cuts to raise the debt limit, which President Biden refuses to do. And while Republicans have also passed a bill to raise the debt ceiling by 1 year, it is considered dead on arrival in the Senate because it asks for a lot of cuts in Social Security and welfare programs. But even then, till last Saturday, President Biden was saying that we have not reached a crunch point yet. But it seems to be changing now because he was recently forced to cut short a planned trip to Asia and return to Washington. On Tuesday, that is May 16th, Biden met four top members of Congress, Republicans McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, and Democrats Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries to raise the debt ceiling and avert the default. While the White House has called this conversation productive and direct without giving a timeline, Speaker McCarthy has said that it is possible to get a deal by the end of the week, which we'll see because he has cautioned that they still have a lot of work to do in a very short amount of time now.
So, Kunal, let's talk about the debt limit and budgets for a second. You've mentioned all these budget issues, but we need to raise the debt limit. The debt limit, is it stopping future spending? What's exactly going on here?
So basically, actually, the debt ceiling has nothing to do with the budget. Debt ceiling is about how the US government can pay back its obligations. Obligation it has already incurred. This is not extra borrowing to fund new programs. This is basically continued borrowing to pay your older debt. And this is how typically governments function. Even during Trump's time, as I already said, the debt ceiling was raised by $3 trillion to facilitate this. It is a very unique situation in the 2011 event, 2013 event, and current event where Republicans are trying to tie up the debt ceiling with actual budgetary or monetary decisions. Since they have leverage in Congress, as it happened in 2011 and 2013, they believe that they can concede, they can get the Democrats to concede some of their demands, which is basically always around spending cuts. So that is the basic situation here. Again, like I said, this is not spending which is going to happen. This is spending which you have already incurred and you need to pay back for it. You don't generate enough revenues to pay back it for in a real time. That is why you borrow more money. So basically, this is not a debt ceiling.
Okay.
In that manner.
Just to be clear for our audience, we're not making a value judgment on Republicans or Democrats on this issue. We're just trying to deal with the facts. And the facts are that Republicans, when they've been in control of either the House or the Senate, they've decided to leverage the debt ceiling to try to extract some concessions from Democrats. Now, that also brings up a larger issue in terms of the budget process that we have, because the federal fiscal year starts on October 1st, and there's a process where we're supposed to go through committees and have 12 different budget resolutions and come to a decision, and there's a vote. Seems like we're circumventing all of that. Now, is it fair to say that this debt ceiling is being weaponized, regardless of which party is doing it, but that the debt ceiling is being weaponized? Is that fair?
Exactly. I mean, like in the past decade, a couple of times, even the budget process has been weaponized to cause government shutdowns. Even if the presidents and the Democrats give concessions to the Republicans and pass this, again, in budget session, you will have another similar sorts of demands and which can lead to a government shutdown even then. And anyways, the issues that the Democrats are asking for, you can use it during the budget debate because revenues and expenditures are a subject of the budget debate. What Republicans are trying to do is associate expenditure with the debt ceiling, which is not really true. The money that is borrowed through the debt ceiling is used to cover the expenditure in the budget. But these are not directly linked so that you cannot make a case that spending should be cut to raise the debt ceiling. They are very lightly linked, to say the least.
Okay, and there's also consequences to this sort of activity because President Biden is going on a foreign trip that he's actually having to cut short. And again, not making value judgments, but it's just that there are ramifications and consequences to something that seems like it should be handled through the regular order, as it's called, in the congressional federal budget process, and it's not. But let's move forward. So we're at this crunch point. So what happens if we don't get the debt ceiling raised in time? What are the consequences?
Paul, I think given the past evidence, this is already sort of a crunch situation. Because for a moment, let's assume that this standoff will be resolved as it happened in 2011 and 13. But even then, the uncertainty caused by this theater leads to significant damage to the economy. So a report by the Treasury Department found that the 2011 debt ceiling standoff caused a $2.4 trillion decline in total household wealth. In addition, rating agencies downgraded the U.S. from its top AAA rating to AA+, sending the markets into a freefall. While so far this time, the markets have largely resisted the looming panic, the current $31.4 trillion ceiling, debt ceiling, has already been reached. So now the Department of Treasury is using accounting gimmicks or extraordinary measures, they call it, to pay government's bills. After the X date, which seems more and more likely to be 1st of June, it's hard to predict what will happen because truly it is an unprecedented situation. But the cascading impacts of the default would probably compound because a pause in federal payments would hurt the economy, which would hurt the stock market, which would in turn hurt the economy even more, and so on. And the people who are going to be impacted first and foremost by this are the people who are receiving some form of payment from the federal government or some type of program that is funded by the federal government. This includes seniors and individuals with disabilities who receive social security payments, veterans, federal employees, etc. So some estimates have suggested that more than 8 million jobs could be wiped out and that the housing market could see a 23% decline in sales. The White House Council of Economic Advisors has said that the economy, the broader economy, could contract by as much as 6%, which would be similar to what happened in 2008 recession.
So specifically, what happens in the municipal market when the debt ceiling is reached?
I mean, Paul, basically, first of all, if the government cannot meet its financial obligations, this will include delays in payments of principal and interest on existing government bonds. Right. So, and it will definitely cause disruptions in the muni market as well. These disruptions raise concerns about the credit worthiness of the government and will cause investors to demand higher yields and interest rates on municipal securities. Also, this uncertainty can create a risk-averse environment where investors will become hesitant to invest in muni markets due to a concern about the overall stability of the system. As a result, the prices of muni securities could drop, their yields could rise, making borrowing costs even higher for the local and state governments. But that is not all. State governments and local governments will have to delay or even cancel new bond issuances due to uncertain market conditions, which could stall important infrastructure projects. Moreover, if the debt ceiling is not raised in a timely manner, or if it is not raised at all, it could lead to downgrades in the credit ratings of the US government. This downgrade will then trickle down to affect the credit ratings of state governments and local governments, increasing their borrowing costs even further and probably convention defaults. This is a very tricky situation. In fact, this prolonged showdown over the US debt limit is already expected to depress muni bond supply in the first half of the year as issuers continue to pull back amid political volatility and potential spending cuts.
Let's hope in the next couple of weeks, regardless of anybody's political perspective, that we get this debt ceiling raised and we start dealing with these tough issues that we have on the federal level as far as budget concerns.
I think markets are also counting upon that only. That is why they haven't reacted too volatilely.
Right. And hopefully we can start to deal with budget issues in the budget process and not use this debt ceiling, which seems like it's tangential. It's debt we already have accounted for that we're still going to have to pay for. This will definitely be something keeping everybody's attention. But thank you, Kunal. Thank you, Deb, for your contributions to this week's podcast. To our audience, I hope you found this episode informative. Thank you for listening to the Muni Lowdown. Please support us by liking, sharing, and or subscribing to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere that you listen to podcasts. Join us every Thursday for the latest drop of the Muni Lowdown. Take care. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the host and guests. They do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of ION Analytics or any affiliated entities. The information shared in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be considered as professional advice. While we make every effort to ensure the accuracy and reliability of the information discussed, we cannot guarantee that all information provided is complete, current, or applicable to every individual's unique circumstances. Therefore, it is always recommended to seek professional advice or conduct further research before making any decisions based on the content of this podcast. The content of this podcast may occasionally touch upon sensitive or controversial topics. We strive to approach these subjects with respect, empathy, and open-mindedness. However, listeners should be aware that different opinions and perspectives may be presented. It is our intention to foster constructive dialogue and encourage critical thinking. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree that the Muni Lowdown, its hosts, guests, and production team will not be held responsible or liable for any direct, indirect, incidental, consequential, or other damages that may arise from your reliance on or use of the information presented in this podcast. Thank you for joining us on this journey of exploration and learning.